From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
When headquarters sent a memo every morning and said, we want to touch on the following issues, we want to cover the following stories, we want to do them in this particular way, our job and our objective then was to execute the plan.
Today, a new documentary, Outfoxed, Rupert Murdoch's War on Journalism, will take a look at the film that charges Fox News Channel tailors its news to back President Bush. We'll speak with the filmmaker Robert Greenwald, as well as a former Fox News commentator Larry Johnson, who worked with the CIA, and Chilean poet and Nobel laureate Pablo Neruda would have turned 100 years old this week.
Las altas soledades de Machu Picchu en la puerta del cielo estaban llenas de aceites y cantos. El hombre había roto las moradas.
We'll speak with poet and professor Martina Espada, who recently returned from Chile to participate in the celebration of the Neruda centenary. First, though, we'll go to Iraq to speak with journalist Robert Fisk. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Journalist Seymour Hersh, who broke the Abu Ghraib prison torture scandal, is now saying the U.S. has evidence showing the abuse was even worse than previously reported. Although he's yet to report on it in the pages of The New Yorker, Hersh recently told a crowd in California that the U.S. has videotape showing young male Iraqi prisoners being sodomized by U.S. troops in prison. Hersh said, quote, the boys were sodomized with the cameras rolling, and the worst part is the soundtrack of the boys shrieking. He added, quote, this is your government at war. In news from Iraq, the head of security at Iraq's foreign ministry was assassinated, and two other officials were wounded when gunmen attacked their convoy north of Baghdad to Kirkuk. On Wednesday, the governor of Mosul was also assassinated. Britain and Australia have blocked a move by the U.S. to build a $10 million museum in Baghdad to document the atrocities of Saddam Hussein's regime. This according to a report in The Guardian of London. The U.S. wanted to take $10 million from Iraqi oil revenue to build the museum, which the U.S. described as a special commitment to Paul Bremer, to the Iraqi people. Australia rejected the idea, saying it should be up to the Iraqi people, not the U.S., to decide how to spend the money. The Army dropped legal actions against Staff Sergeant Jorge Andres Pugani, who was arrested and charged with cowardice in Iraq last year when he had a panic attack upon seeing a dead body. The charges were apparently dropped because an Army malaria drug made the soldier sick, this according to a report by UPI. He's one of the 11 service members diagnosed in the past few weeks with damage to the brainstem and vestibular after being given mefloquine while serving in Iraq or Afghanistan. A number of soldiers from Pugani's base in Fort Carson, Colorado, say the drug caused serious mental and physical problems, including suicidal feelings and homicidal rage. The Army developed mefloquine, also known as Larium, in the 1970s. It was cleared for use in the United States in 1989. It's been taken by 5 million Americans. In labor news, the National Labor Relations Board reversed itself yesterday and determined that graduate students at private universities do not have the right to unionize. This reverses a 2000 decision by the board that led to students at New York University forming the first graduate employees union. The American Federation of Teachers called yesterday's decision outrageous. An official from the group said, quote, these people obviously are workers. If members of the NLRB can't recognize a worker when they see one, they shouldn't be on a national labor board. 13 members of the House of Representatives have asked the United Nations to monitor the U.S. presidential election in November. The group of lawmakers points to the lack of federal oversight and says monitoring is needed to avert, quote, another Florida. Several major civic groups, including Common Cause and Global Exchange, are also taking the unprecedented action of setting up election monitoring projects. A new United Nations report has found that the AIDS epidemic has caused life expectancy in some African countries to drop to just 33 years. For the seventh year in a row, Sierra Leone has the shortest life expectancy. Africa is home to about 25 million of the estimated 38 million people infected with HIV/AIDS. The annual General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church recently voted to stop investing in Israel, and leaders of the church officially equated Israel with apartheid South Africa, this according to the Forward newspaper. The Presbyterian Church, which has 3 million members, is the first Christian denomination to make such a move. The Anti-Defamation League has blasted the vote. In a letter to the church, the ADL wrote, quote, "To assert that there's a moral equivalency between the racist policy of apartheid and the efforts to protect the citizenry of Israel is unconscionable," the ADL said. Meanwhile, New Zealand has imposed diplomatic sanctions on Israel and is accusing Israel of sending two spies from Mossad to illegally obtain a New Zealand passport. The men have pled guilty to trying to obtain the passports, but deny they work for the Mossad. The Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Lab has been forced to shut down from doing classified work after the lab lost highly sensitive secret information from a unit of the lab known as the Weapons Physics Directorate. The Senate voted last night to give $12 billion to tobacco growers as part of a larger deal that would allow the Federal Drug Administration to regulate the sale, marketing, and manufacture of tobacco products. According to the New York Times, the deal to give tobacco growers $12 billion was attached to a bill that was supposed to remove corporate tax credits. In southern India, at least 70 children have died, 100 more injured, after a massive fire at a local school. Most of those killed were between 4 and 10 years old. A Los Angeles man has filed a $25 million claim with the city 3 weeks after he was beaten by the Los Angeles Police Department. The June 23rd attack was caught on videotape and was compared by many to the beating of Rodney King. During part of the beating, one officer struck the unarmed man 11 times with a metal flashlight. The victim, Stanley Miller, said the beating has left him with brain damage. Trespassing charges were dropped against two people who wore anti-Bush T-shirts at the president's speech in West Virginia on July 4th. Nicole and Jeff Rank were removed from the event in restraints by members of the Secret Service after revealing T-shirts that read, "Love America, Hate Bush." The judge dismissed the charges because the city ordinance did not include trespassing on the statehouse grounds. And the California-based Project Billboard has reached an agreement with Clear Channel that will allow the group to purchase two large billboard spots in Times Square during the Republican National Convention. Project Billboard was forced to sue Clear Channel after the company rejected a billboard ad because of its anti-war message. The controversial billboard read, quote, "Democracy is best taught by example, not by war." And finally, yesterday in New York, United for Peace and Justice held a brief protest to demonstrate against the New York Police Department's decision not to grant the group a permit to hold a rally in Central Park during the Republican National Convention. The head of United for Peace and Justice, Leslie Kagan, spoke outside New York City Hall.
So we've put now five different options on the table. The Great Lawn in Central Park, the North Meadow in Central Park, the Great Lawn and the North Meadow. If they say we're too big for one of those sites, give us both and we'll divide people up. Times Square and Third Avenue. We put five options on the table. They have put one option on the table, and now they're not even saying it's an option. They're saying take it or leave it. We don't think that's the way to conduct honest and good faith negotiations.
Leslie Kagan of United for Peace and Justice. Those are the headlines.
We want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. We as the young wish to say in this song, God bless great America. We give thanks to the old for achieving their goal. It is now up to us, and we know we must build up a trust. And we want the power for the people. That's all we ask in our country, dear. The sick and the hungry are unable. Protect them and those who may live in fear. Power for the people.
Power for the People here on Democracy Now! Curtis Mayfield. This is Democracy Now!, the largest public media collaboration in the country, broadcasting on over 240 Pacifica radio stations, NPR stations, public access TV stations, PBS, and Free Speech TV, which is channel 9415 of Dish Network, and we welcome Link TV, which is on DirecTV channel 375 and on Dish Network channel 9410. The new Iraq is in chaos. Since the so-called transfer of sovereignty in Iraq on June 28th, over 30 people have been killed. This week alone, two car bombs in Baghdad killed at least 22 people. Now, the unelected interim prime minister, Alawi, says he is going to create a new secret police force, raising alarms among Iraqis who had suffered at the hands of Saddam Hussein's secret police. The violence continues unabated, despite the comments from the U.S. and its allies in the invasion. After the most recent bombing, London Independent Middle East correspondent Robert Fisk writes, quote, at the Al-Yarmouk Hospital in Baghdad yesterday morning, there was blood on the walls, blood on the floor, blood on the doctors, blood on the stretchers. In the dangerous oven of Baghdad, 10 more lives had just ended. So what was it Tony Blair said in the Commons yesterday afternoon? We are not killing civilians in Iraq. Terrorists are killing civilians in Iraq, he said. So that's all right then. Question, are Baghdad and London on the same planet? We're going to be speaking to Robert Fisk later in the program, the chief Middle East correspondent for the London Independent. But first, we're going to go to a new documentary that is now airing around the country. It's called Outfoxed, Rupert Murdoch's War on Journalism. It takes a look at how the Fox News Channel tailored its news coverage to back President Bush. We're going to speak with the filmmaker, Robert Greenwald, as well as a former Fox News commentator, Larry Johnson, who worked with the CIA. But first, we're going to play an excerpt from Outfoxed.
I suspect your research has discovered the memoranda that were written by John Moody and by Roger in terms of setting the tone for the day. The message of the day is a very political device.
Let's spend a good deal of time on the battle over judicial nominations, which the president will address this morning. Nominees who both sides admit are qualified are being held up because of their possible, not demonstrated, views on one issue, abortion. This should be a trademark issue for FNC today and in the days to come.
There was nothing covert about the way the managing editors in New York or Washington operated. They made it perfectly clear what they expected from us.
The so-called 9/11 Commission has already been meeting. This is not what did he know and when did he know it stuff. Do not turn this into Watergate.
Every morning, there was a detailed list of subjects to talk about, not talk about.
Kerry's speech on the economy at Georgetown is likely to move onto the topic of Iraq. We should take the beginning of the Kerry speech and see if other news at the time is more compelling. It is not required to take it start to finish.
They were just actually issuing edicts to the reporters to control what they could say and how they could say it.
Let's refer to the U.S. Marines we see in the foreground as sharpshooters, not snipers, which carries a negative connotation.
When headquarters sent a memo every morning and said, we want to touch on the following issues, we want to cover the following stories, we want to do them in this particular way, our job and our objective then was to execute the plan.
An excerpt from the new film Outfoxed, Rupert Murdoch's War on Journalism. The filmmaker is Robert Greenwald. He joins us on the line. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Nice to be with you, Amy.
Well, that pretty well laid out the thesis, but why don't you further explain these memos that you got a hold of?
Well, what was amazing in working on this movie was the level of cooperation I got from former Fox employees and current Fox employees. I mean, I think the Fox people would be shocked at how many people cooperated with me, and among the cooperation I got was 15 different memos selected over a period of time, which just roughly indicate how the Fox news people are given specific instructions how to interpret the news, what they should say and how they should say it. No other news organization in the world does that, but they do that at the, quote, fair and balanced network, which we all know is unfair and unbalanced. But what I wanted to do was prove it objectively. And so I have the memos, I have seven or nine former Foxies, I have clips from Fox News, and this quite brilliant study that FAIR did comparing guests on their news show to Republicans to Democrats. Surprise, surprise, 80% Republicans and 20% Democrats on their primary news show.
We're talking to Robert Greenwald, the filmmaker who did Outfox, that's now showing around the country. We are also joined on the line by Larry Johnson. He's a former Fox commentator, worked with the CIA. Larry Johnson, you spoke a great deal in this film. What about your experience at Fox?
Well, as I said at the press conference the other day, I was never personally directed on what I could say and couldn't say, but I will note that after I came out and said that going into Iraq would be a diversion on the war on terrorism and would, in fact, probably lead to more terrorism, Fox stopped using me. So there, what I saw more importantly was in dealing with some of the other correspondents and staff, I'll call it the fear factor. They were terrified of upper management if they ran afoul of not following the party line. And they made it clear to me that the party line was presented every morning in these memos that Robert has shown on the movie.
Robert Greenwald, can you introduce this next clip we're about to play, which has to do with some, well, positive coverage of Iraq at times when the situation was quite dire.
What I did in the film in general, Amy, I had these amazing media monitors, people from all over the country who volunteered, who were watching Fox News collectively up to 18 hours a day. I gave them 10 categories to look for. And whenever they would see one of these categories, they would give me an email with the time and date of the incident so we could download it and edit it. One of the categories which emerged over our research, as I was so struck by it, was what I initially laughingly called Happy Iraq, but it stayed as that title because we couldn't think of a better one, not meaning to insult any of the terrible tragedy and deaths that are going on over there. So what you'll hear is the Fox line on Happy Iraq, because for a period of time I thought I was in some alternative universe watching clip after clip of how wonderful things were over there.
We're going to go to that clip in a minute, but first we're going to break. We're speaking with Robert Greenwald. He's the filmmaker who has just produced the film Outfoxed, Rupert Murdoch's War on Journalism. Also on the line with us, former Fox News commentator Larry Johnson. We'll be back with them in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we look at the new film that is airing around the country, it's called Outfoxed, Rupert Murdoch's War on Journalism. Robert Greenwald just introducing this clip about what is going on in Iraq. It begins with John Nichols, who is an editor at the Capital Times in Madison, Wisconsin, and with The Nation magazine.
Fox has made a decision to present the Iraq War as a success and as an ongoing success.
The Baghdad Equestrian Club is open for business. And yes, you can play these ponies.
It's the Iraq you don't hear about. Falling unemployment, rising wages, interest rates down, foreign investment up.
Life for 95% of the Iraqis is already immeasurably better than it was under the decades of Saddam's rule. There's no question about that, and that's what's the least reported story over there. You go to the markets, they're thriving. Big fat fish coming out of the Tigris and the Euphrates River.
Young men in Baghdad blowing off steam with their cars. The guys gather to put their wheels through the paces once a week, something they say they were not allowed to do under the old regime.
The senior producer told the two or three writers for her news hour, she told us, now just keep in mind, it's all good. This is such a fair and balanced issue. Keep it positive. We've got to emphasize all the good that we're doing. She, at that point, made a reference to rebuilding schools, bringing democracy to Iraq. And then she said, see, big progress. Yoo-hoo for us. Things were actually, at that point, going quite badly. Many more American soldiers were dying each day, and God knows how many Iraqis.
277 U.S. soldiers have now died in Iraq, which means that, statistically speaking, U.S. soldiers have less of a chance of dying from all causes in Iraq than citizens have of being murdered in California, which is roughly the same geographical size.
Britt Hume of Fox News. Robert Greenwald, your comment on that last comment.
Well, I don't even have the words to describe the sort of ridiculousness, the mean-spiritedness, but it is consistent with Fox News. You know, that is what they do. When they take the party line, and by the way, the other thing that was interesting in the research is, it's not that they're a conservative network, because, you know, conservatives have, even though I disagree with them, they have a variety of positions, but what you get on Fox News is exclusive. exclusively the Bush administration line. So you never see other conservative positions on the deficit, on unemployment, on taxes, even on the war itself. You just get the Bush line over and over again. And by the way, one thing we should say, Amy, it is available to the listeners. You can go to outfox.org and order it now. And as of yesterday, believe it or not, we were number one on Amazon. And even more fun is if you Google Rupert Murdoch yesterday, first they gave a Time magazine interview, but the second thing under Rupert Murdoch was Outfoxed, which I'm sure makes them incredibly happy over there.
Robert Greenwald is the filmmaker who did Outfox that is just out this week. You have a clip of Carl Cameron, who is interviewing President Bush, Carl Cameron of Fox News. Can you set this clip up for us?
Yes. Through many of the wonderful sources who came forward during the work on the film, a source was able to get me this clip, which is it's 2000. Bush is running for president, and he's chatting with Cameron before the on-air part of the cameras kick in. But what they weren't aware of is somehow, somewhere, the camera was in fact rolling, and I was able to get tape of this discussion. Now remember, this is just before they go on the air, and they're having this friendly chat.
This is Carl Cameron speaking with George Bush just before their interview.
Sat for an interview with in Austin with Fox News Channel's Carl Cameron, who joins us now with highlights. Hello, Carl.
Hi, Brett. Well,
it was well known in the summer of 2000 that Fox's lead political correspondent covering the Bush campaign, that his wife was campaigning for Bush.
Bush does have a halo. Okay. Tell me when you're ready.
Things are good. Your family?
Very well. My wife has been hanging out with your sister.
Yeah, good. My county.
Laura's been all over the state campaigning, and Paulina's been constantly with her.
Nora's a good person.
She's been terrific. I mean, to hear Pauline tell it, when she first started campaigning for you, she was a little bit nervous.
Yeah.
But now she's up
getting
there.
Getting a stride?
She doesn't need notes. She's going to crowds, and she's got the whole riff
down. She's a good soul.
She's having fun, too.
She's a really good soul.
And in any other news organization, in fact, in CNN that very summer, there was a producer whose husband was a lawyer for the Gore team. And this was a producer who would have naturally covered Gore, who was immediately told, you're not to have anything to do with campaign coverage, either covering Bush or covering Gore, because of the possible conflict of interest or the perception of a conflict of interest. At Fox, they didn't care. The fact that the senior political reporter, his wife, is actually campaigning for the Bush campaign at a time when this guy's covering them, that didn't even register. It never would have occurred.
All right, you guys ready? All right.
That's great.
Here we go, Governor. See, the little things that get disclosed.
I like that.
Thank you for joining us, sir.
Yes, sir. Thanks, Carl. It's good to see you again.
Just a few days away from the convention.
That's the lack of having some sort of basic journalistic integrity that is just missing from that organization.
And that was Carl Cameron, a Fox News reporter, interviewing George Bush on the campaign trail in 2000. The voice you heard over it was a disguised voice of an anonymous Fox producer. This is Democracy Now! As we look at this new film, Outfoxed. We did call Fox yesterday for comment. They wouldn't return our calls. But you've been criticized, Robert Greenwald, for not contacting Fox until the very end of this film. Why didn't you call them earlier?
First of all, two words, Al Franken. We know they're litigious. We know that they would sue to stop me. And we know they would have done everything possible to stop me, number one. Number two, I find it so ironic. Here is Fox News. They're on the air 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and people are saying, oh, but in your little film, you didn't give them time to reply. Well, they've got plenty of time to reply, number one. Number two, they've now seen the film, and they're not replying to you, Amy, and they're not replying to other media. Well, if they're so upset about not giving their chance to reply, I welcome now the chance to reply. In fact, I've offered to say, they can air the movie for free on Fox Network and discuss it. We'll make it available to them. But there doesn't seem to be any comment from the network that's always busy commenting. Although I must say, there was a reporter on the air, I think it was 2 days ago, it may be my favorite comment, and we've posted it on our outfox.org website, and he said, the film is unfair, it's a hit job, it's not balanced, and I haven't seen it yet, which to me sums up the Fox News reporting style.
You use a device in this film of repetition. Now, in this next clip we're going to look at, it has to do with the coverage of John Kerry and Fox's attitude toward the French. Robert Greenwald set it up for us.
One of the things we found in one of the categories that I had the media monitors look for was pro-Bush, anti-Kerry. And I have, I think it's over 600 pages of collected emails just in this one category. And I said, well, how am I going to do this? So I broke it down into different areas where they are pro-Bush, anti-Kerry, which, by the way, again, your listeners know all of this, but it's fairly shocking to have a so-called news organization passionately committed to electing one candidate and defeating another one. So in an effort to put a little bit of humor into this, we created the Kerry is French category, since for some reason that seemed to be a reason not to elect him president.
Let's go to Outfoxed.
You're saying John Kerry looks French.
John Kerry looks French.
Kerry, the man who would be America's first French president.
When you're at war, there are two models. You have the Churchill, Reagan, Thatcher, Tony Blair, George Bush model, or you have the McGovern, Jimmy Carter, French John Kerry model.
Are the Republicans going to effectively be able to make Kerry French? Good afternoon, everybody, or as John Kerry would say, bonjour.
French are thinkers. And that doesn't go into the code of the American presidency. I mean, you know the French, the thinker, le penseur, Rodin. I mean, they think, and they never do anything with their thinking. I believe that Mr. Kerry has to get away of this image if he wants to win. Right now, I think he's not in the American archetype. Why? He's on vacation. If the archetype is to take action and you are taking vacation, I mean, you're definitely not, you don't fit the code, you are off code.
And Mr. Rapai,
yes.
Thank you very much. You are hereby invited back.
And that was a clip from Outfoxed, which is actually a series of clips from the Fox network. This is Democracy Now! As we talk about this new documentary, again, we called Fox for comment. They did not return our call. And we're also on the line with Larry Johnson. What is the discussion that goes on in the Fox newsroom? Is there concern expressed about, for example, the memos or the approach to take? How much dissent is open? How much is covert? How much is, you know, discussed quietly?
There is no open dissent. I mean, one of the more famous cases is that's not well known out in public. As David Schuster, who used to be a correspondent on Fox, he had the audacity to challenge a statement by Carl Cameron, as the story's told to me, where Carl Cameron was telling George Bush in another one of these behind-the-scenes interplays about how he'd played basketball at a certain college. And Schuster said, you know, you never went to college there, and you didn't play college basketball. Next thing you know, he's fired from Fox for challenging the veracity of Carl Cameron. And it's the kind of thing, I guess, that it's still in litigation, and he's terrified to talk about it. But it sent messages to other members of the Fox, Fox correspondents and bookers and producers, that you know they just knew you did not stray outside the line, or you would be thrown overboard in a heartbeat.
You know, I have to say, as I watched this, I thought this film, Outfoxed, could have included some of the other networks, especially the repetition around war and support for the war. Robert Greenwald, did you find that yourself? I mean, whether it was CNN or ABC or CBS, NBC, Fair also did a study of all the nightly network newscasts, or the four major ones, ABC, NBC, CBS, and the PBS NewsHour, with Jim Lehrer in the 2 weeks around Colin Powell giving his push for war at the UN on February 5th, 2003. And of the four major nightly newscasts, there were 393 interviews done. There were only three with anti-war representatives, three of almost 400. And that actually did not include Fox.
No, you're absolutely right, Amy. And fortunately, you made that film, so I didn't have to. And a wonderful film it is, which deals with some of that. The other networks, and I say this in some ways when I talk about the Foxification effect, which was my effort to do this, which was not to let the other networks off the hook, because I think when we look back on the war, it will turn out to be one of the great scandals and tragedies of our media, the way the media handled the build-up to war. But I couldn't, A, do everything in the movie. So what I focused on was the Foxification effect, where you have Christine Amanpour talking about the fact on camera that the Fox foot soldiers, as it were, affected the coverage of all the networks. Because that's where, in some ways, it's most dangerous. Not just that it's out there doing what it does, but because it's financially successful, it pulls the other networks in its direction in two ways. One is this pseudo-patriotism, which we saw around the war, and the other, which is, you know, almost as important, is the cheapening of real news. It's a lot easier and a lot less expensive to put two people in a room screaming at each other than it is to have real reporters go out all over the world and do stories. They don't do that, and therefore, unfortunately, they're profitable. And when you have large corporations dominating the media, they see that, ooh, here's an easy and inexpensive way to make money, and they move in that direction, and news on all the networks is harmed as a result.
Well, we're going to end with the perhaps most famous of the Fox employees' faces on the air, O'Reilly. And we're going to take a look at one of the things he said. The clip begins with a statement he made, actually not on the air. Where was this speech?
Which
when O'Reilly was talking about never having said shut up.
Oh, that was actually on the air. The one that wasn't on the air was the very last one where he was at a conference with Al Franken.
Let's go to Outfoxed.
Paul Evans, Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Bill, if you are so concerned about public figures being bad role models for children, please stop rudely interrupting your guests and telling them to shut up. Well, the shut up line has happened only once in 6 years, Ms. Evans.
Well, you know, I think that asking a student to stay in the closet in order to go
I'm
to school
asking you
is a
to
lot
shut
like
up
asking
about
an African-American
no, 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 no.
student.
No, no, no.
I know what
shut
I was
up.
Doing.
Shut up.
Please
as
don't
respect,
tell me
as respect. Why did you have to tell him you were an atheist if you didn't have any trouble reading the oath? Why didn't you just shut up? What Jimmy Carter should do is privately give Mr. Bush his opinion and shut up publicly. That would be best for the country.
And it is our duty as loyal Americans to shut up once the fighting begins.
Once the war against Saddam begins, we expect every American to support our military, and if they can't do that, to shut up.
All he's got in 6.5 years is that I misspoke, that I labeled a Polk Award a Peabody. He writes it in his book. He tries to make me out
no,
to
no,
be
no, 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 no,
hey,
no, that's
shut
not
up.
No,
you had your 35
up.
Minutes. Shut up.
And that was Bill O'Reilly in the film Outfoxed by Robert Greenwald. Robert Greenwald, I want to thank you very much for being with us. The film is called Outfoxed, Rupert Murdoch's War on Journalism. If people want to get a hold of this documentary, it's a little different than other places. It's not just coming out of movie theaters, is that right?
Correct. We're doing alternative distribution, which I passionately believed in. It's what we did with Uncovered, and you and your listeners and others were able to get it and support it. Over 100,000 copies of Uncovered, which, by the way, will be in movie theaters this summer, brought to us by Cinema Libre. But for Outfoxed, if you go to outfoxed.org, you can order the film. You can go to a house party this Sunday that Move On is organizing. There are over 3,000 house parties around the country. Or you can, you know, order it, see it, show it to your friends and enemies, show it to Fox lovers. And you can also go on the website. There's all kinds of fun additional material there and clips from the film and links to, and this may be most important, Amy, links to media activist groups, because it's not enough to see the movie and get irritated. What we must do is take action. And you will find a terrific site where we list various groups, what they're doing, how you can work with them, how you can help. This is a battle we can win in general. We can help change the media. There are a lot of fights ahead of us, and we need to have the resources, which includes people getting involved, to be able to do those battles.
Robert Greenwald, I want to thank you very much for being with us, as well as Larry Johnson, formerly worked with the CIA and a former Fox News commentator. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, a very different perspective, we will go to Baghdad, and we'll speak with independent reporter Robert Fisk about what's happening there on the ground.
A toda la humanidad, ningún cañón borrará el surco de tu arrozal, el derecho
de vivir en paz. Indochina es el lugar más allá del ancho mar, donde revientan las olas con genocidio y napalm. La luna es una explosión que funde todo el clamor, el derecho de vivir en paz.
Victor Jara of Chile. In just a few minutes, we'll be talking with Martina Spada about the great Chilean poet Pablo Neruda, who would have been 100 years old this week. But first, we go to Baghdad to independent reporter Robert Fisk. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Robert.
Thank you.
Well, we have just been spending the last half hour talking about Fox News coverage of Iraq and other issues involving the Bush administration. But we'd like to turn to you now to talk about what is happening on the ground.
Well, one thing that is happening on the ground is that the reporting of Iraq has reached a point where hardly any journalists leave Baghdad, and some of them don't even leave their hotels. One of the reasons why the Bush administration is getting away with so much at the moment is that the degree of anarchy, the sheer size of the area of Iraq outside government or American control, is being hidden from ordinary people. For example, in the town of Bakuba, there are now hundreds of armed men. In Ramadi and Fallujah, they're virtually people's republics, in which even the Americans cannot move freely. We do not realize, that we should, the degree to which the country of Iraq is outside the control of the new American established government of Iyad Alawi. You know, we promise the people here democracy, and we're giving them now martial law, telephone tapping, mail opening, special raids on houses, forget about habeas corpus. The big problem at the moment is that the degree of violence across the country is not getting across. For example, when 10 people were killed and 33 wounded by a suicide bomber in the center of Baghdad, it went around the world as headlines. When 10 people were killed and 33 wounded in Kirkuk, we didn't hear about it. And this is a major problem. We now find ourselves restricted by the danger. Now, I'm still able to move around Baghdad, and I can still travel outside Baghdad, but only after days of preparation. And so what we're doing, in effect, is that we are being circumscribed in our movements, which, of course, suits the authorities, because we can't report the dozens of deaths going on elsewhere in the country. And at the same time, the insurgency continues. Alawi, who, of course, was a CIA operative and is now the interim, quote, prime minister, unquote, made a statement in the last 24 hours saying it's going to get worse. So we're still back in the same old Alice in Wonderland world. Everything is getting better. Democracy is coming, and everything is getting worse.
We're talking to Robert Fisk in Baghdad. Can you talk about the Al Yarmouk Hospital and the time you spent there and what you saw?
Well, when I got there, as always, after major bombings and atrocities, there was chaos. There were a large number of people believing that their families may have been wounded or killed. Of course, any family who knew that their loved ones were queuing at the gate at that moment to enter the Iraqi government compound naturally assumed the worst and rushed to the hospital. Some of the people being brought in, some of the wounded, were so badly mutilated and covered in so much blood they were unrecognizable. One woman clearly did not at first recognize her own husband. One man came in with only a stump at the end of his arm. And I remember thinking crazily, I saw a human hand, beside one of the bombed vehicles. I wonder if it was his hand. That's the kind of horror that people here now face daily, and which we see, at least if we go out, we see. I think that there's a... there's one thing that is very constantly said here, which one has to say and admit, that Iraqis say they'd rather have law than democracy, and they want an end to this abyss of lawlessness. Just 24 hours ago, I went to the funeral of a senior official in the industry ministry, a man whose job actually was to check the accounts to prevent fraud by the big contracting agencies who are rebuilding Iraq. He was a father of seven children. I met his youngest son and his oldest son. Mohammed was 11, and his eldest son Akram was 20. And he came back home, bringing his family their breakfast, milk, cream, bread, a car with three men in, one of them with a cell phone, called another vehicle, a pickup truck, would arrive with two very professional killers, two shots in the head, two shots in the stomach. The family found him lying with one leg still in his car. And at the funeral, and at the funeral meal afterwards, it's a tradition in the Muslim world to meet with all the family afterwards in a tent in the street outside. One of the sons said to me, you know, we would like democracy, but we've had 35 years without, and it has given freedom to thieves and murderers, not to us. These people want more stricter laws. They want the return of capital punishment. I'm sorry to say, but that's what they say. That's what they say they want. It doesn't mean they want Saddam back, but that's what they say they want. And a measure of the lawlessness and the horror is that when they return for the second time to the mosque to collect the coffin in which to put the body of the dead civil servant, a man called Sabal Karim, there was a bomb inside the coffin. It didn't go off. When I visited the funeral tent, they had surrounded it with vehicles because they were frightened someone might drive a car loaded with explosives, a suicide bomber might drive into the funeral tent. Now that is the extent of fear and horror and danger that Iraq is going through. Though I dare say you're not reading that in the American press all the time.
No, we're not. What about Robert Fisk? What has happened since the so-called handover in terms of the laws that the unelected Prime Minister Alawi is implementing?
Well, you see, it sounds good on television if you believe in strong laws. Martial law, telephone tapping, a new Directorate of Public Security as opposed to the Directorate of National Security, which is what it was called under Saddam. Asked where the Ba'ath Party officials are coming back into the interrogation service, Alawi said they are professionals. Well, the only professional Iraqi interrogators are those who work for Saddam, the ones we supposedly are supposed to be putting on trial someday for crimes against humanity. But you see, most Iraqis want to hear this. They are so fearful of the insecurity and the killings. They are so fearful of the kidnapping and rape of women, which is happening, that they want these laws. But what they're not being given is what we promised them, which is democracy. Now, the whole issue, of course, is that nobody here actually believes that I meet that Alawi really is the Iraqi prime minister. They see him as being a creature of the United States. He's a former CIA operative. He said at a press conference he'd taken money in the past from 14 different intelligence agencies. Iraqis were not impressed when they saw the pictures of the first appearance of Saddam Hussein at a trial, when the top right-hand side of the screen said cleared by U.S. military. John Negroponte of Honduras fame is not here as a routine ambassador. He's here for a purpose. And most people I talk to in the streets of Baghdad, most of my Iraqi friends, say basically Alawi works for the Americans. It wouldn't be difficult to see how Alawi could be popular. If he were to say all American troops and all foreign troops must leave Iraq in 6 weeks, he'd be the most popular prime minister this country ever had. He'd probably win an election. But, of course, he's not going to say that. And so we come back to the same problem, which is foreign occupation. As, you know, I've said before, I think, on your program, the Americans must leave Iraq. They will leave Iraq. And they can't leave Iraq. And that is the equation which is torturing the country and the United States at the moment.
Robert Fisk, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Robert Fisk speaking to us from Baghdad, Iraq. He is a longtime correspondent for the independent newspaper in Britain. This is Democracy Now! As we turn now to an anniversary of sorts, Chilean poet and Nobel laureate Pablo Neruda would have turned 100 years old this week. Fellow Nobel Prize winner Gabriel Garcia Marquez called Pablo Neruda the, quote, greatest poet of the 20th century in any language. Born the son of a railway worker, Neruda began writing poetry when he was 14 years old, didn't stop until his death in 1973. A long-standing Communist Party supporter, Pablo Neruda died less than 2 weeks after General Augusto Pinochet overthrew Salvador Allende's government in a U.S.-backed coup. His funeral became the first public show of opposition to Chile's military rulers. His work was banned until 1990 under the Pinochet regime. This week, many Chilean towns and cities have been staging poetry readings to mark Neruda's centenary, while restaurants have prepared special menus based on his odes to the onion. We're joined right now by Martina Spada, poet and professor at the University of Massachusetts. It's Amherst, where he teaches creative writing, poetry, and the work of Pablo Neruda, has just returned from Chile. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. Well, what was happening in Chile around this 100th anniversary of the birth of Pablo Neruda?
Oh, so many things. There was a celebration sponsored by the government of Chile, and in fact, I was invited to Chile by a presidential commission set up for that purpose. But there was also a popular celebration throughout Chile, which really manifested itself most clearly at Isla Negra, perhaps the most famous writer's house in the world belonging to Neruda, this past Sunday, the day before his 100th birthday. An extraordinary gathering took place there, and I was very fortunate to be there, too.
Can you talk about Pablo Neruda's significance?
Well, I agree with the assessment of Gabriel Garcia Marquez that Neruda was the greatest poet of the 20th century in any language. And there really is a Neruda for everyone. There's Neruda the love poet, Neruda the surrealist poet, Neruda the poet of historical epic, Neruda the political poet, Neruda the poet of common things with the odes, Neruda the poet of the sea, and so on. But throughout it all, we see with Neruda, first of all, a great compassion for other human beings, no matter which phase of his career we're talking about, and secondly, a deep appreciation for the fact of being alive, which again we see at every stage for Neruda.
We're talking to Martina Spada, who has taught for many years the work of Pablo Neruda, has just returned from Chile, where there is a national celebration going on of the life of Pablo Neruda. What about the period at the end of his life, what he understood was happening in Chile as he died less than 2 weeks after Pinochet rose to power?
Neruda's death is inseparable from the coup that took place, of course, September the 11th, 1973, the first September 11th. And at the time, Neruda was very ill with prostate cancer. Certainly, the coup hastened his death. He was aware of what was going on. He was aware of the destruction of Chile, the destruction of his vision for socialist Chile, and, of course, the death of many friends, including Salvador Allende. So these things became inseparable. Neruda's death and the death of democracy in Chile. It's significant that when Neruda died, his widow, Matilda, brought his body to lay in state at another one of his houses called La Chascona in Santiago. She did this specifically because the military had trashed the house, and she wanted the world to see what was going on with La Chascona, the house in Santiago, but also what was happening with the coup in Chile at the time.
Yes, there were other September 11th. September 11th, 1973 is the day Salvador Allende died in the palace in Chile as the Pinochet forces rose to power. When you are teaching Pablo Neruda, when you're first introducing students, is there a poem that you share with them or an excerpt or a book that you recommend they go to first?
Well, I teach Neruda according to the chronology of his life. It's a very easy thing to do because his poetry reflected his life so closely in so many ways. Certainly, we often gravitate to Neruda, the political poet, and certainly there's no greater political poem than his masterpiece, The Heights of Machu Picchu, Alturas de Machu Picchu. Neruda visited the ruins of an Inca city in the Andes in Peru in 1943, and subsequently wrote a book-length poem in 12 parts celebrating the achievement of Machu Picchu, but also condemning the oppression, the slavery, which made it possible. And ultimately, in the 12th canto, calling upon the dead, centuries of the dead, to be born again and to speak through him.
Let's hear a clip of that poem actually read by Pablo Neruda, Alturas de Machu Picchu.
Las altas soledades de Machu Picchu en la puerta del cielo estaban llenas de aceites y cantos. El hombre había roto las moradas de grandes aves en la altura y en el nuevo dominio entre las cumbres el labrador tocaba la semilla con sus dedos heridos por la nieve. Todo es silencio de agua y viento, pero en las hojas mira el guerrero, entre los alerces un grito, unos ojos de tigre en medio de las alturas de la nieve. Mira las lanzas descansando, escucha el susurro del aire atravesado por las flechas, mira los pechos y las piernas y las cabelleras sombrías brillando a la luz de la luna. Mira el vacío de los guerreros, no hay nadie. Trina la diuca como el agua en la noche pura, cruza el cóndor su vuelo negro. No hay nadie, escuchas, es el paso del puma en el aire y las hojas. No hay nadie, escucha, escucha el árbol araucano. No hay nadie, mira las piedras de Arauco. No hay nadie, solo son los árboles, solo son las piedras, Arauco.
Pablo Neruda reading from his poem, Alturas de Machu Picchu. A special thanks to the Pacifica Radio Archives, which has a collection of his readings as well as tens of thousands of other recordings. Very loose translation of this section of this epic poem, Martín Espada.
Well, Neruda realizes once he comes to the heights of Machu Picchu, that this magnificent achievement has been built on what he calls a groundwork of rags. And there's a turning point in the poem where he essentially accuses the city, confronts the city with these questions about the slave that was buried there. And you can hear the passion in his voice at this point in the poem. There's a real powerful indignation there, and what becomes clear, you can hear it from the tone of his reading, is that there's a very, very close association between Pablo Neruda's poetry and the idea of justice. And the people of Chile today, even now, associate Pablo Neruda with the idea of justice. I saw something really.
5 seconds.
I saw something really extraordinary at Isla Negra when I was there, a gathering of the families of the disappeared and the detained who came to his tomb with photographs and placards
Martina Espada, we have to leave it there. I want to thank you very much for being with us as we honor Pablo Neruda on this week that would have been his 100th birthday. That does it for the show. Headed to Pittsburgh tonight, Carnegie Mellon University tonight at 7 o'clock. Tomorrow at Fort Lauderdale, the Wyndham Hotel, Principles of American Democracy, Atlanta on Wednesday, Provincetown, Massachusetts on next week. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks to Sharif Abdulkadus, Mike Burke. Thanks to Matt O'Neill. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.